Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, your week in review, Republican lawmakers for the second time reject every building project proposed in Governor Tony Evers' capital budget. A new lawsuit brought by a conservative businessman seeks to end the use of ballot drop boxes and other voting practices in the state.
We're going to be moving up to March 22nd.
And Wisconsin residents with certain medical conditions will be eligible for the COVID-19 vaccine 1 week earlier than expected. Rewind, your week in review for March 19th.
I'm Brianna Riley.
I'm J.R. Ross.
This week, the State Building Commission again deadlocked over Governor Tony Evers' proposed building projects. Republican lawmakers rejected each project included in Governor Tony Evers' $2.4 billion capital budget proposal, which mirrors the actions the commission took 2 years ago under Governor Evers' first capital budget. Each proposal failed along a 4-4 party line vote. The plan now heads to the Joint Finance Committee, which is led by Republicans, where members can pick and choose which projects they want to green light. Evers in 2019 sought approval for a $2.5 billion capital budget. That was pared back to around $1.8 billion by the legislature. During the meeting, Republicans cited the $3.2 billion the state is set to receive from the latest coronavirus relief package the federal government passed in recent weeks. JR, any surprises over the Building Commission's votes this week?
No, and really, you got to understand, traditionally, the Building Commission vote in the capital budget was kind of formality. You know, they would send it on to Joint Finance, and the committee would really rework it the way it wanted to anyway or make changes. 2 years ago was the first time that anybody could find that I know of where you had this 4-4 vote and they deadlocked. And what the Republicans want to do is to send the capital budget to the committee with no recommendation. Then when that failed, they went through line by line. The impact is still the same, though. It goes to the committee without a recommendation, which we all knew wasn't going to matter because Republicans reworked this thing anyway. What I'm watching for is how much will they pare it back? We talked to Rob Swearingen, for example, Republican member of the Assembly from Rhinelander, who's on the Building Commission. He wants to see $1 billion cut, though I don't know if that's the target for Joint Finance. But what I can tell you is there are some obvious projects that are not going to make the cut when it's all said and done. For example, Governor Evers wants to spend a little more than $160 million on a new state office building in Milwaukee. That has two strikes against it. One, Republicans want to pare back the overall spending of this thing. Two, you know, it's a symbol for Republicans of that state employees aren't back to work in person right now. So if they're not in their offices right now, how do you justify bringing together 1,000 of them in one single point in a brand new office building? Do we need that? But that's the question I'm hearing from Republicans. So you'll see things like that. What will be interesting to watch too is a lot of these projects are in Republican districts. So sometimes if you're looking to cut something, it's a little hard to do when it's in your own backyard. What is the standard going to be for Republicans when it comes to the capital budget, and what are they going to be okay with in terms of investments? You know, things like a lot of this budget is maintenance. You know, you don't want to neglect that because it's a long-term cost if you don't do it. But new buildings, that might be a tough sell in some of these provisions that governor wants to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what I didn't mention before was I think the interest from Republicans in focusing on the federal coronavirus relief money is the question of whether any of those funds can be used for state building projects. Do you anticipate us getting any answers on that front anytime soon, JR?
Well, kind of the vibe that I heard was that Republicans are hoping that when Joint Finance gets this capital budget, they'll also get a memo from the Fiscal Bureau, which is the nonpartisan budget arm of the legislature, give them an idea of like how this money could be used. Now, one thing to remember, right now, Governor Evers is the only person who has a say in how that money is spent. There is no legislative oversight for that $3.2 billion. I don't anticipate him giving up that power. There's a bill currently pending before legislature that would give Joint Finance a review of whatever the governor wants to do with it. People expect them to sign that. Governors are loath to give up any powers, regardless of what party they are from. So that said, I'm not sure how that fits with, you know, what Joint Finance wants to do. I'd be interested to see how that memo looks and what the argument becomes from joint finance when it comes to these building projects with that money coming in.
And I think that's something we'll definitely cover here on Rewind when that memo is out. Let's head now to a video where we'll hear from four members of the Building Commission, Representative Swearingen, Billings, Witke, and then Governor Tony Evers.
From my perspective, I'm just simply not comfortable with the amount of money that the capital budget spends. I'm also not sure what the legislature is comfortable with in terms of bonding levels. This capital budget does not reflect the potential $3.2 billion that the state of Wisconsin is going to get in from the federal government. And you're asking us to, you know, essentially build new buildings and government is not currently at work.
I have toured a lot of these campuses. I've looked at buildings from basements to roofs and talked with students, faculty, staff who do the mechanical upkeep of some of our buildings that really need to be replaced or need maintenance, but the work has been deferred and delayed. The time is now.
Though I believe that we need to make strategic investments to build our workforce and to support the things that will make our state move forward, at this point in time, based on the process that we have in front of us, I cannot see debating $2 billion worth of projects.
This is one of the few opportunities, if not the only one, where the executive branch and the legislative branch moves projects forward. And I think the legislature that created this, the Building Commission, were wise in doing it. So for us to take a pass on the ability to pull together, you know, make the decisions that need to be made. And, you know, unfortunately, there was very little discussion yesterday or the day before. So it's hard to, at this point in time, craft something that everybody can agree to. But that's our job. And I just find it unacceptable that we are going to choose not to do what the folks that created this law want us to do, and that's to come up with a building plan that reflects the needs of the people of Wisconsin.
Lawmakers are working to revitalize bills that didn't pass last session. They made some more progress on that front with Assembly and Senate floor periods this week. In all, 120 bills cleared the Assembly and Senate, but were never taken up by the Senate after COVID-19 cut the regular session short. Meanwhile, other bills struggled to gain traction in one or the other chamber, including one measure to protect coverage of those with pre-existing conditions in the case of the Federal Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, going away. Two others, meanwhile, seek to track and process rape kits in an effort to prevent an overall another backlog in the processing and testing of those kits. Those are some of the bills that passed one of the chambers this week. Meanwhile, other bills approved include one that requires or would require Holocaust education in schools, and another that seeks to lower prescription drug prices by regulating pharmacy benefit managers. There are, of course, other avenues for bringing bills back. The budget, for example, we're already seeing from Governor Tony Evers some of the water quality bills that were from the bipartisan task force being included in that. But I want to jump back to proposals facing more of an uphill battle. Pre-existing conditions, the rape kit bills. Does legislation like that have a chance to pass this time around, JR?
Yeah, we just have to see with the dynamic in the other house. I mean, the whole idea behind the requirement to protect those with pre-existing conditions is that became a huge campaign issue in 2018. And remember, at the end of the year, we weren't really expecting that to be like one of the themes of the governor's race in 2018. But because Wisconsin, under former Attorney General Brad Schimmel, with the okay of former Governor Scott Walker, joined the lawsuit to overturn the ACA, that became a huge issue. Republicans have been vulnerable on that one. This is to shore up that flank on that. The rape test kit bills are really interesting because basically identical versions of these bills passed last session to what passed this week. There's really, the only difference I really saw was that the Department of Justice has found a federal grant to pay for the cost of this new tracking system that we have to create under the bill versus using state money to do it. What happened last time, though, is when it got to the Assembly, Health Committee Chair Joe Sanfilippo raised concerns about the bills. There was a push for changes. And there were provisions added to that package in a new bill, things like requiring if the person accused of sexual assault is a legal immigrant, that there be a report to ICE, that Senate authors saw were poison pills, and the bill just went nowhere. The thought last session was that Speaker Robin Voss did not want to give new Dem Attorney General Josh Call a win on this backlog issue. It was a big campaign issue in 2018. It actually has been an issue off and on for like 20 years in Wisconsin. It's popped up from now and then. And this would be a way to kind of put it to rest. The question I have now is this bill got a better chance in the Assembly? Has that kind of opposition gone away? Interesting note that last session, the bill went to San Filippo's Health Committee. This session is before John Spiros and his committee. So might that be a sign it's going to get through? We'll have to keep an eye on it and watch.
Yeah, and jumping back to the pre-existing conditions bill, it was interesting. Last session, we saw some Democratic opposition from it on the Assembly floor. Democrats said it didn't go far enough. This time it passed with unanimous support. But, of course, now it heads to the Senate, where it was hung up last time. Another bill I'm keeping an eye on, sort of in this category of bills that died last session and are being revitalized, is one that would allow pharmacists to prescribe birth control to women 18 and older. That's another one that passed the Assembly. It didn't get unanimous Republican support, but then it got hung up in the Republican Senate caucus. So I'm wondering the influence that new blood in that caucus might have on bills like this. JR, do you have any thoughts on sort of the mix-up in the caucuses and how that might play out?
Well, the caucus is definitely not less conservative than it was last time. We also are down a member right now. Remember, Scott Fitzgerald, the old majority leader, his seat is still open. John Jagler, state representative from Watertown, Republican, is the heavy favorite to win a very Republican seat in the April 6th special election. So we'll see how that plays if John does win as we kind of expect, what the numbers mean. It's also going to be interesting to watch the dynamic under Devin LeMahieu, the new majority leader, of what is his policy going to be on bills if you don't have 17 Republican votes. Now, it's not a hard, fast rule for the majority party that you never put a bill on the floor if it doesn't have enough votes from your caucus to pass without the minority party. But it's often not worth the hassle of alienating four or five or six members of your caucus by putting a bill on the floor that they don't like. So how is it going to impact the debate on some of these bills that they've got a lot of support and even a majority of the Republican caucus support, but not enough to pass a bill without asking Dems for help? I just got to keep an eye on that.
A really interesting dynamic. In other session news, Republicans voted to block rules regulating PFAS and banning conversion therapy. Lawmakers drafted bills to uphold suspensions of seven different agency rules. The Assembly and Senate then sent those bills to committee this week during floor periods, essentially blocking the underlying rules for the remainder of the session. Among the rules that were partially blocked were ones to limit PFAS contamination, as I mentioned before, prohibit conversion therapy, which is a practice advocates argue is especially harmful to youth struggling with their sexuality, and bar landlords from charging fees for late rent payments during COVID-19. The move essentially allows the legislature to avoid getting approval from Governor Evers to uphold lawmakers' objections. The PFAS rule was particularly of interest to me. The legislature passed a bill last session to ban the use of firefighting foam and direct the DNR to promulgate a rule regarding foam containment and disposal. DNR then went ahead and did that, and lawmakers, Republicans on the Joint Committee for Review of Administrative Rules, some agency groups, argued that some of the parts of that rule overstepped DNR's authority. Jared, what stood out to you in this debate, and can you speak to whether this is how the state intended the administrative rule process to work?
Well, I get the impression this is a symbol of, or signal of, a more aggressive Joint Committee for Review of Administrative Rules. Remember, in the administrative rules process, the legislature passes laws and sometimes you got to fill in the blanks. And when agencies try to do that, sometimes Republicans or lawmakers feel like they overstep what was intended. And what you're seeing is JCRAR taking more aggressive stance to say, no, you can't do that, especially with the Elections Commission. We talked about this a little bit before with this Elections Commission dynamic about the rules or the guidance that it's put out there. This is going to be a new thing with the Joint Committee of Reviewing Rules, where they're going to kind of really keep a hawk's eye on these agencies. I mean, especially because it's a Democratic administration, right? So when it was Governor Scott Walker, a little bit different story because it's all Republican control. But now you have a Democratic administration, they're going to get more scrutiny. For example, the conversion therapy ban. There's no state law in Wisconsin that bans conversion therapy. What the rule would have done was basically declared that if you practice that conversion therapy, it's unprofessional conduct. It would have been a de facto ban. But that's not what the law allows. And so this is an example of where the committee is saying, you can't do that. That's not in the law, so you're not allowed to do that. What I want to know is this going to continue the entire next 2 years? And how does the agency respond to this? What's going to happen going forward, that working relationship between their administration and lawmakers, which hasn't been great so far?
And this is more of an aside, but on the PFAS rule in particular, I had some environmental advocates comment this week that if the legislature doesn't allow the DNR to promulgate a rule that contains certain parts that still, sort of explicitly relate back to firefighting foam in limiting its treatment and disposal, what does that mean for broader efforts to try to address PFAS contamination? And that especially comes into play when we're thinking about the makeup of the Assembly Republican Caucus. John Nygren from Marinette, the former Joint Finance Committee co-chair, who retired in December, was a really big proponent of these measures because of the contamination in his own district. Without that heavy hitter in that caucus, is it possible that efforts on PFAS could stall, despite the fact that there are a few dozen contamination sites around the state? Now, industry groups say, if DNR would just follow the rules and stay in its lane, we'll be able to make progress on these issues. But that's another thing tangentially going off of this that I'm watching for.
Oh, I mean, excellent point. Plus, two, don't forget, these motions to send these bills to committee, there were two Republicans who did not support the motion to send committee the PFAS rule objection: Eric Wimberger, Republican from Green Bay, and Rob Coles, another Republican from Green Bay. Where's one of the hot spots in Wisconsin? Up in the Fox Valley up by Green Bay. I mean, really, Madison and the Marinette, Peshtigo area, kind of north and west of Green Bay, those are the hot spots. It's residents back home. They know there's an issue there, and they're feeling it, whereas a lot of people in the legislature are not feeling the same intensity because they're not seeing the issue in their districts.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear more now from Senator Kelda Royce and Steve Noss on the Senate floor regarding this PFAS rule.
What good is a law if it can't be enforced? And I think this is just part of a broader pattern to try to dismantle the most important parts of democracy, whether you're attacking voting rights, whether it's gerrymandering the districts so that voters can't have a fair say, or whether it's, in essence, pretending to do something about a serious problem facing our constituents and then secretly killing it through this rules process. This is wrong. If you decided that we don't care about poisonous water anymore, we don't think PFAS are a problem, then this body should vote to repeal the law that was passed.
We cannot allow various departments, whether it's Department of Natural Resources, revenue, any of them, to go outside the boundaries of what we legislators who represent the people have defined in the legislation we pass. We would have chaos if we allowed the departments to go willy-nilly and jump the fence and take up whatever they want and wrap it into an administrative rule. We need to contain what is requested of the legislature so that departments don't just go in any direction they please, whatever it may be in.
A new lawsuit is challenging ballot drop boxes and other voting measures. A Waukesha businessman sued the Wisconsin Supreme Court to stop the use of ballot drop boxes and bar clerks from filling in missing information on absentee ballot envelopes, as well as ban ballot harvesting. It's unlikely the court will rule in time to impact the spring election on April 6th. Also worth noting, the Wisconsin Elections Commission allowed the use of drop boxes and allowed clerks to fill in missing witness address information on ballot envelopes. JR, these practices have been targeted in previous lawsuits, including from President Trump. Have justices signaled where they stand on some of these issues?
State Supreme Court ruling on the Trump lawsuit, the majority ruling was that the basically was filed too late, that these policies have been in place for a while, you waited too long to challenge them. We didn't get a clear direction from the court about where it stood on the law. The only hint we have is conservative Justice Brian Hagedorn, who wrote the majority opinion, did a concurring opinion to his majority opinion, that basically said, if I got to the merits, this is how I would have viewed things. And one thing he said was that the law is somewhat silent on this whole issue about what constitutes a complete address or completing the absolute ballot envelope and what you can fill in. So we don't have a clear indication from them. Now, the assumption at the time was that the three liberal justices on the court, Ann Walsh Bradley, Jill Karofsky, and Rebecca Dallet, would likely join Hagedorn if that's his position about what the law says. But we're making an assumption there. There's no clear indication. And the three conservatives, other three conservatives on there, Pat Rogensack, Annette Ziegler, Rebecca Bradley, we get the hint from them that they've got some issues about filling in absentee ballot envelopes, maybe about drop boxes. So be interesting to watch if the court gets the merits of this case, because even if they don't rule before April 6th, we're still going to be in the eye of the storm in 2022, and this could be a big issue. So this could actually be a chance to set down a controlling Supreme Court ruling on what the law says in these instances.
Mm-hmm. And this suit was filed three weeks out from the election, but based on the briefing schedule set by the majority of the court, I think briefs are due March 30th from the Wisconsin Elections Commission. So there's not a lot of time there to issue a ruling in that period. The three of the four conservative justices did seek an expedited process, but that didn't end up panning out. Moving on now to new updates in COVID-19 news this week. Due to increased supply and availability of appointments, officials have moved up vaccine eligibility for Phase 1C to March 22nd. That's moved up a week from March 29th. DHS has also clarified those eligible to receive vaccine shots now include essential criminal court personnel, clergy, and restaurant workers. This week, FEMA arrived at Milwaukee's COVID-19 vaccine site. FEMA will also support another site in Eau Claire, opening April 8th. Wisconsin, for months, the Journal Sentinel reported this week, has underreported COVID-19 deaths in long-term care facilities. The Department of Health Services told the Associated Press that officials are, quote, woefully behind in cleaning up COVID-19 data. Now, Senator Alberta Darling, a Republican senator, on Thursday used that to call for an audit of the Department of Health Services and its handling of COVID-19 data. JR, there's lots of COVID-related news this week. What are you watching for in the coming weeks as eligibility increases?
Well, on the vaccine front, a key thing in policy is always under-promise and over-deliver. So if you watch what's been going on with the vaccine rollout lately, we've been moving up the date steadily from where we thought we were going to be to where it's going to end up. So, you know, look, you know, I'm 47 years old. I've got no pre-existing health conditions. I was expecting at one point that it was going to be like maybe late summer, early fall. Now we're talking May. If you're somebody who's not eligible right now and you're thinking May 1st is the date you're going to likely get it, they move it up a week or two that you're in the line. It feels like, okay, this is like good news, right? So watch that. Are there more deadlines moved up to get people in? With this whole issue about the underreporting of deaths in the nursing homes, kind of watching if this gets legs at this point. You know, the Republican criticism of Governor Evers with the role of vaccine is muted quite a bit, because we've gone from one of the worst to one of the best in terms of getting shots in arms and those kinds of things. But this is now an opportunity to try to tarnish the legacy or the work that's been done when it comes to COVID-19 and the decisions that have been made. I just don't know yet from talking to people if it's got enough legs to really kind of become an issue. Republicans try to make it like Andrew Cuomo-like. We're not in that realm yet. But just keep an eye on that issue and see how it progresses if it becomes a bigger deal in the coming days and weeks.
I think the question on my end, though, is how big of an issue is COVID-19 going to be in the upcoming campaign cycle in the 2022 midterms? Do you have any sense of that yet?
Well, I know with Governor Evers, 2 months ago, we were talking about the three possible arguments against him, which one was the unemployment insurance problems with getting claims filled. Two was Kenosha, what happened there. And the third leg of the stool, the argument against him, was going to be possibly this vaccine rollout. He's done a pretty good job of taking that third leg away. Now, it's obviously, like I said, with the whole underreporting thing, there might be some more to watch there. But right now, it looks like this is a success for Governor Evers. It is still, we're still early. And I think he said something this week that kind of hinted at that it's not time to spike the ball yet when it comes to COVID-19. But it's in much better shape than it was before. And with President Biden, they've been doing the same thing, where they keep moving up the dates a little bit, you know, more doses coming in, those kind of things, that there's a little bit more hope and optimism about what's going on. The wall we're going to hit eventually is going to be the people who don't want to get a vaccine, they have an issue with it, they think it's not safe, you know, whatever reason it is, right, that we're going to hit a wall where we're not going to get to 100% vaccination. The question is, do we get to herd immunity, where between people vaccinated, those who have had it, et cetera, that we're at a place where we're back to quote-unquote normal sometime this year, and the earlier it happens, the better it is for people who are running the show when it comes to next fall.
Let's go now to a video clip from DHS Deputy Secretary Julie Williams-Van Dyke on current accessibility of COVID-19 vaccines.
Should people be waiting for appointments to become available in their immediate community, or is it okay for them to be traveling around the state in order to get the shot?
The challenge it places is we do allocate vaccine based on the population of a county, and if lots and lots of people do that, that means the people in that county won't have as much access either. In terms of people going early, at this point, again, we want to get vaccine in arms, and if people have open slots and have vaccine, I'm not concerned. I don't think it's going to be a free-for-all. I think what is really important is we want people to make room for those who have these medical conditions to get in the front of the line. If you're someone with one of these conditions that's milder and you see open appointments as you did this morning, Adam, then I don't see any problem with going ahead and booking it and getting in line to get your vaccine.
Let's go to stock picks now. JR, what's rising this week?
Rising at COVID ads. So a dozen years ago, Democrats passed a big stimulus package under Barack Obama. That was meant to help in a financial crisis. They failed to adequately promote that package afterward, and Republicans successfully defined it for voters as a waste of taxpayer money. Democrats are not going to make that same mistake again, at least try not to. We've already seen the last week and a half an ad now running in Milwaukee with Joe Biden's comments about the COVID bill. We've seen the DCCC, the House Majority Forward PAC, both doing digital and broadcast ads for Ron Kind out in Western Wisconsin. Now, that's a whole different sub-story about whether Ron Kind's vulnerable because you haven't seen what his district will look like after the next round of lines, but they're not going to allow Republicans to try to define this. And they all start from a position of strength because looking at the polling, people are happy with it. But, you know, like somebody pointed to me this week, if you're getting a check for $5,000, you're going to be happy no matter what, right? So the question is, can Republicans turn this thing around? Ron Johnson's getting knocked with ads about his opposition to the bill. But you're seeing also as Republican efforts to do things like highlight that prisoners can get money under the stimulus bill. Now, keep in mind, there wasn't much of a peep about the first two bills that were signed by President Trump that didn't stop prisoners from getting money. And the IRS lost a lawsuit back in the fall. Basically, federal judge said you can't prevent prisoners from getting money. That said, you're going to see Republicans trying to define this more as a waste of taxpayer money to try and turn the tide against the package ahead of next fall, because it could be a big issue when we get to election time.
All right, mixed?
Tax cuts. So a provision that COVID bill says that basically you can't take federal money from the COVID bill and then cut state taxes. Now, the keys are going to be, how do you define that? And we're waiting for the Treasury Department to fill in the blanks of like what that means, how it's going to interpret that law. We've already got one attorney general from Ohio who sued over that in federal court. We have 21 Republican attorneys general who have also threatened to sue. And in looking at the Wisconsin budget and what's going to come up, the question is, like the governor's budget, for example, it has a net tax increase. There are tax cuts in there, but overall would raise taxes. Does that meet the definition of the law? And Republican lawmakers, talking to them, they're not going to be stopped from trying to do a tax cut because of the federal provision. What might happen, though, is they pass a budget that has a tax cut. We see the governor signs it, and if he does, then do we end up in court where we got to see if it applies with federal law? So keep an eye on that going forward.
And falling briefly.
Ron Johnson, he seems to be the only Republican I can find in Wisconsin who wants to not only keep talking about January 6th, but keep trying to redefine the insurrection at the Capitol. Another kind of foot-in-the-mouth moment where he said that he wasn't afraid of the people who were storming the Capitol, but would have been afraid of the Black Lives Matter protesters or Antifa. Critics immediately seized on the fact that most of those people who were at the Capitol January 6th were white, whereas a lot of Black Lives Matter protesters are obviously black. So there's, you know, there's a racial issue to that. It's just kind of an interesting dynamic with Johnson that he is doubling down on what he's saying and keeps pushing things that are kind of just a little outside the mainstream. The interesting dynamic is that he knows that as long as he hasn't said what he's going to do in terms of running for election in 2022, he's going to get attention. I had one theory. I've been asking people, like, why is he doing it? What's the strategy behind this? Because it's not helping somebody with not great poll numbers pull in people in the middle. And the opinion I got back was that Ron Johnson is saying what he believes and what he wants to say, knowing that he's got a platform. And then once he's done saying his piece, he'll kind of see where he is and make a decision about running. But that decision might not come until 2022, which could make life tough for Republicans to hold that seat.
Thanks, JR, and thanks for watching. I'm Brianna Riley.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Next week, the Assembly's back in session, so stay tuned for that. And that was Rewind, your week in review for March 19th.